If you like what you hear on the Security Ledger podcast, you might want to check out one of our cybersecurity newsletters like the Daily Ledger or the Weekly Ledger. You can sign up for them at securityledger.com/subscribe. Hello, Happy New Year, and welcome to another edition of the Security Ledger podcast. I'm Paul Roberts, Editor-in-Chief at the Security Ledger. It's been a really exciting year for our signature podcast here at Security Ledger. So for this, our final episode of 2017, we've decided to take a look back at some of our most popular segments from the last year based on listens and downloads, basically audience response. Perhaps it's a reflection of the charged and politicized times we're living in, but many of these episodes touch on issues that cross the boundary between information security and politics. They include our first segment from episode number 58, which aired back in August. In that edition of the Security Ledger podcast, we spoke with Bev Harris of the nonprofit organization Black Box Voting about the recently passed DEF CON hacking conference in Las Vegas, where there was a voting village that let some of the world's best hackers square off against commonly used voting machines with predictable results. So in this conversation, I started by asking Bev, who attended DEF CON, about the risk of hacks on discrete voting machines and whether that wasn't a problem that was overblown. She strongly disagreed with me, and you can hear our conversation here.
Yes, my name is Bev Harris, and I'm an author. I also founded an organization called Black Box Voting.
You said you were at DEF CON, but you did not go to the vote hacking village because you already knew what they were going to find, which was that these systems were very vulnerable. Do you think that those demonstrations are useful, or are they misleading or overblown? I mean, many of the hacks they talk about are, you know, require physical access to the voting machine, hooking a keyboard up to it, for example. Things that, while concerning, probably aren't scalable to affect, you know, a huge number of votes.
Not true.
Okay.
Let's look at bank taking money from banks, stealing from banks. About 68% of all funds ever stolen from banks is stolen by someone with inside access. Historically, with elections, typically they were stolen by someone with inside access. The idea that only an outside hacker would steal an election is actually not very realistic. It typically would be somebody who has some level of inside access. There's inside access at the local level. And then through these middlemen and contractors, there's people who have inside access at a multiple level. And then you have the foreign powers, which would have, fairly sophisticated ways to get at multiple middlemen at once. So there's several levels. And that's why I think that we don't want to focus on a Homeland Security type style solution where, oh, let's make it even more opaque and encrypted and controlled by a single party. Instead, you make sure that the public can see and authenticate everything anytime they want to. It basically crowdsources the authentication process. I used to worry a lot about who the vendors were and where they, and it's relevant, but you have to take, let's say you just make the assumption that somebody somewhere, you don't know who, an insider, is going to do something they shouldn't. That's the thing you protect against. And the way to protect against that is by opening it up and crowdsourcing the authentication.
The New York Times had an op-ed to protect voting, use open source software. I wonder if you saw that and what your thoughts on that argument are.
It's one thing that's a good thing. It doesn't solve it. It doesn't give you public transparency. There is one definite benefit that I've seen. When I've been out in the field attempting to authenticate, a lot of times I'll want to see an audit log or a database or, you know, the program that did it. And it would take away their ability to say, you can't see the audit log because it's proprietary. We can't show you, the program that did the system because it's proprietary. It would make it subject to freedom of information. But open source in and of itself doesn't solve the transparency problem, but it helps.
So in your opinion, it's almost a certainty then that either errors or tampering with electronic voting systems have tipped elections in one way or the other in the United States.
Oh, yeah, that it's happened. And there's a lot of documented situations. Now, whether it's an error or tampering is probably not knowable in most cases. So you have to basically say that we need to be able to tell whether it's the numbers they're reporting are true or false. And regardless of whether it's human error or intent, it's not okay. And we know that although they often claim it's human error, we know that elections have been misreported, sometimes ridiculously so. In Arkansas, there was an election where they actually gave votes to the wrong race. For example, they gave sheriff's votes to a judge. You know, it was like not even the right thing on the ballot that right. got it. And clearly it was wrong. There's been a number of elections they've had to rerun because it was, they call it incurable uncertainty, where they never could figure out who should have won because of the way the machine was counting.
One way of looking at is at what you're saying is that there are motivations for rigging elections, that it might not be a grand conspiracy orchestrated from, you know, the suburbs of Washington, D.C., or it might be a much more local matter, but that it isn't that uncommon and that it's a manifestation of just corruption of the political within the political system.
Well, it's money. If you look at right. this, again, quantifying it, there's one federal election every 4 years, but there's about 100,000 local elections, which control hundreds of billions of dollars in contract signing. The contract awarding process controls a tremendous amount of money. And the most vulnerable positions that I've found, the ones that have had the most problems of indictments and so forth, are sheriff, which controls guns, contraband, and drugs, city council and county commissioner type positions because they control contract signing authority. And the contracts are huge. They're, you know, millions and millions of dollars for waste management and all those kind of things like that. And I was surprised and a little disheartened to find that the third most common one was judges, the judicial system. And their deal is they sometimes get bribes for delivering certain verdicts. And more often, they get kickbacks for putting people in certain correctional facilities. What's great about this kind of research is I'm not basing it on any kind of theory or conspiracy theory. I'm using the indictments themselves. And they have wiretaps of the people actually saying what they're doing. So, you know, judges are elected at various levels, the sheriff, these commissioners, and a lot of times they need to get elected because they are the key vote to get a particular waste management contract through or something. There is a real monetary incentive, and it's repeated thousands of times over in these different local places. It's important for Americans to understand that these temptations exist for our public officials, and that one of the mitigations is for us to be able to control you know, who gets in office and really know that when they tell us that somebody got into office, that they really did get voted in.
You've said that you think the kind of locally based or state based election system, decentralized system is a good thing, that you don't want it federally controlled. On the other hand, is there more that the federal government could be doing to shore up the integrity of this system short of taking control of it? And if so, what?
Federal government, an appropriate area for it in terms of elections is civil rights protection. And civil rights is not just about minority rights or ethnic rights. It's also about public freedom of information rights. If they started to address the issue of the public right to know, the public right to authenticate, that would be an appropriate use of federal power. And they could leave it to the states as to how to enact that. I think we are seeing attempts to do power grabs in a number of areas, not just elections. It isn't a situation where everybody can just sit back and go, well, you know, someone else has got it. I have tremendous respect for these citizens who have gone forth and said, look, this doesn't seem right. I am going to litigate pro se if necessary. I mean, it's really in an interesting stage for me, a kind of an optimistic stage, because I am seeing citizens step up to the plate and challenge, and they are winning fairly regularly.
Bev Harris of Black Box Voting, thanks for coming in and talking to the Security Ledger.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Following the 2016 presidential election, there has been tremendous attention to the risks posed by nation-state hackers to U.S. critical infrastructure, whether that's our country's voting systems, as we heard in the last segment, or its electrical grid. While Russia and China have long been among the U.S.'s top cyber adversaries, 2017 saw the emergence of North Korea as a potent force driving cyber espionage and cyber criminal operations, including the WannaCry wiper malware and financially motivated attacks on cryptocurrency exchanges. One of our most listened to podcasts from 2017, episode number 71 from November, saw Security Ledger digging deep into the actions and capabilities of the North Koreans with Adam Myers, the vice president of intelligence at the firm CrowdStrike. Myers told us that it's only in the last 2 years, really, that the government of North Korea has begun targeting organizations outside of South Korea, but that the nation's exact intentions are still unclear.
Adam Myers, and my title is VP of Intelligence. Looking back a couple of weeks ago, we were tracking and started reporting on targeting of defense contractors and financials by a threat actor that we call Labyrinth Kalima, which industry folks typically track as under the name HaUp, which is the name of the remote access toolkit that they deploy. And they were using English language and Korean language decoys where they were trying to leverage job-themed kind of, you know, looking for jobs or how to interview for a job type of things. And use that to entice the would-be target to open the file, and that would deploy this remote access toolkit.
So what we're talking about here are attacks targeted at employees of these firms that maybe have business selling weapons or developing weapon systems?
It would be HR-related targeting. So it might be sending at a potential employee, sending them, you know, a job description of something that they might be interested in. We've seen some that involved how to effectively interview at certain locations. And we've seen financially themed ones as well. So it hasn't just been defense contractor.
And what's the MO here? So, okay, they've got the HR, somebody in the HR department, or they've got a prospective candidate or an employee at the company. What then?
So we've tracked North Korean actors, and there's about a handful that we track today. They have a couple of different missions that they partake in. We've seen classic espionage missions where they're trying to steal information that might be sensitive or not publicly available. We've seen them trying to prepare for destructive attacks and to conduct destructive attacks. Examples of that would be, of course, the big one was the Sony Pictures Entertainment attack back in 2014. We also saw have observed targeting by North Korean groups of various power equities within South Korea. There was a wiper attack against power company that was responsible for nuclear power in South Korea. We've seen destructive attacks against financials and media as well in South Korea. So there's been a lot of historic kind of destructive attacks, wiper attacks associated with North Korean actors. And then we've also observed financial attacks where they're trying to generate revenue. Some of these attacks could be ransomware type attacks, or we have associated code overuse between North Korean actors and the actors that perpetrated the SWIFT attacks last year. So some of their mission is to generate revenue for perhaps the regime, perhaps the nuclear program, or even to fund their own operations.
And are these all carried out by the same group? We hear the group, we hear the name Lazarus Group thrown around. Is this all just different operations carried out by the same group, or within North Korea, has this diversified? Are there now multiple groups doing different types of operations, or maybe specializing in a certain type of operation?
From the CrowdStrike perspective, Lazarus is kind of an umbrella term. It overlaps with three of the various groups that we track associated with North Korea. All of the North Korean groups that we track under the name Chalima. And Chalima is an animal that's associated with North Korea pretty closely, and it's a magic flying horse, which was what we were looking for when we were trying to come up with a name for the adversary. We use this digraph or cryptonym for how we track adversaries. So Panda is China, and Russia is Bear, and so North Korea for us is Chalima. And so there's three different of these Chalima actors that we associate with the activity that has been described in industry reporting as Lazarus.
I mean, you guys track, as you said, advanced persistent threat groups across many different countries, Iran, Russia, China. How different is the MO, the modus operandi of the North Korean hacking groups from, say, a Chinese advanced persistent threat group?
So on the motive and how they kind of conduct some of these attacks, they tend to be fairly consistent, right? You break in, you escalate privileges, you move laterally across the infrastructure, find the information that you're looking for, and exfiltrate it out. For espionage operations, in destructive attacks, they effectively run the same playbook, but when they spread laterally, the goal is not to find information and exfiltrate it. It's to deploy tools that can be used to remotely wipe or destroy systems. The financial motivated one is something that is very unique to North Korea. We haven't seen any other actors, Russia, China, etc., really getting involved in revenue generation. They're primarily focused on espionage and in some cases destructive attacks. And with North Korea, that one is definitely unique. In terms of the tools that they use, they build a lot of their own tools, and that's kind of how we kind of attribute them or start to kind of classify them into these categories that we associate with North Korea. In some cases, it's very similar to Russia, China, and other nation states. In some cases, or in some aspects of it, it has unique elements that are, you know, really a hallmark of North Korean activity.
And when we're talking about them being engaged in revenue generation, what types of things are we talking about?
We've seen them involved in using botnets to create fraudulent, you know, advertising type traffic. We've seen them involved in ransomware attacks, and then with the current Swift attacks. And also, there seems to be indication that they may be targeting Bitcoin specific businesses, because if you steal a Bitcoin wallet, that's effectively like stealing cash. And it gives them kind of, one, the ability to get access to that information, or sorry, get access to that that currency very, very cleanly. And two, Bitcoin can be used to subvert the sanctions. So they can spend Bitcoin freely in other places and not really have to worry too much about various sanctions.
This really scrambles the picture. We're used to talking about cyber criminal hacking groups and then advanced persistent threat groups, generally kind of more nation state. But here you have a nation state group that's engaged in explicitly cyber criminal activity.
If you look at North Korea, though, it makes sense. You know, they have to fund a lot of their own operations from the intelligence perspective. And having, if you're involved in cyber espionage and cyber destructive attacks, then using that same capability to generate revenue, to self-fund operations, to help fund, you know, nuclear research, help fund various things that you need to fund. And there's, you know, without getting into all the details, there's a lot of great reporting out there about some of the offices within the North Korean government that have kind of specific interest in currency and gaining access to currency. So, you know, if you look at North Korea as a nation state, too, there's a lot of reporting about some of the things that they do outside of cyber that have similar kind of capabilities. There's the, you know, there's reporting that they've been involved in a lot of counterfeiting of currency. They've been involved in allegedly drug smuggling, involved in human trafficking. So there's all kinds of reporting out there on other aspects of how North Korean offensive capabilities have been leveraged to generate currency as well.
So we know that the North Korean military is interested in weapon systems, interested in U.S. and I'm guessing other countries' defense contractors, want to try and gain an edge in these systems or these weapons that may be used against them in the event of a conflict. How successful have these forays been? Do we know if they've actually obtained any sensitive information on weapon systems use on the Korean Peninsula?
You know, for many, many years, the preponderance of their targeting has been focused on South Korea. It's only, you know, really in the last, you know, couple of years where we've seen an increase on non-South Korean targeting. And, you know, I think that their goal has historically been to disrupt South Korea and try to make things difficult for South Korea. And in recent months, the targeting of defense industrial base, the targeting of financial, you know, we're not really sure what their intentions are. We haven't been able to observe enough of what they're going after within those defense contractors or in the financials to you know, understand, is this espionage or is this potentially, you know, a destructive attack? You know, we're laying the groundwork for a destructive attack. You know, historically, they've conducted both missions. And, you know, with the increasing international tension, you know, we're not sure exactly what they're at right now.
What would be some telltale signs from your standpoint that, oh, this might be about setting the charges, as it were, for some destructive cyber attack that really is intended to just cripple this organization, not to extract information from it?
Historically, they kind of start off as the same thing. And so really, I think that the best guidance that we can give to organizations that are being targeted is to maintain extreme visibility. You have to understand exactly where these guys are on the infrastructure and what they've done while they were there in order to understand, you know, what it was that they were getting into. We've seen tools that they have that have keywords built into them in, you know, they're looking for things like secret and top secret and army and various Korean language equivalencies to that. So they've got a shopping list of things that they're looking for from an espionage perspective.
These companies that make defense systems, like car companies, have very long supply chains. Is there interest amongst the North Koreans and others in targeting those companies in the supply chain as well? And do we see evidence that that's part of their operation?
Over the last quarter or even a little bit more now, we've been tracking an increase in supply chain attacks. We've seen attacks against, you know, they've been in the media, CCleaner and... there was one against Python, right, where they were going after the PyPI, you know, database. We've seen NetSerang. We've seen attacks against
Medox,
Eltima, Handbrake. So there's been a whole slew of increasing vulnerabilities and exploitation of the supply chain. We have not associated any of those with North Korea. But the you know, the incidents are certainly on the increase. They have strong potential for a threat actor that wants to get access to, you know, a hard target to use one of these softer supply chain mechanisms to get access to that hard target.
What about human intelligence? What about the use of, you know, again, putting somebody inside the company who can launch an attack from within their corporate network, or, you know, do we see any evidence that the North is using that approach as well?
Well, let me come back to that. And one more thing, I'll point out that even, you know, just this last week, there was a recently disclosed Crunchyroll incident where Crunchyroll.com had a DNS redirect that caused executables to be downloaded.
When we hear about things like that, that sound kind of like they're consumer focused, or, you know, maybe it's scammers who might be behind that. Should we take a second look?
It might not necessarily be. I mean, the CCleaner attack was, you know, very widespread and had a huge list of potential targets. But the number of targets that were actually, you know, tasked through that were very small. And so, you know, that was a... that's, I think, what you're going to see with the supply chain attack, is that you're going to have a potential exposure that is massively high, but only a very small number of those that were exposed are actually deployed or tasked or have an implant delivered to them. That will be how you can discern a supply chain attack that was meant to say, you know, years ago, the good example was somebody targeted the website that was used for parking at the Super Bowl to push out, you know, e-crime malware. That was a very widespread attack. They wanted to get as many infections as they could. With something like CCleaner, they had a wide potential install base, but a very small subset that was actually actioned. That is, you know, I think how you would see a targeted intrusion by a nation state or, you know, a specific actor like that actually using a supply chain attack to get access to a smaller subset of interesting targets.
Sony Pictures Entertainment came as a huge shock to everybody, both that they were targeted, why they were targeted, you know, over this, you know, the interview, this movie that they made, and obviously the destructiveness of the attack. Where are we with North Korea? Do you feel like the good guys, your company included, have a handle on what they're up to and what they're capable of? Or is it one of these, you know, we'll find out when we find out type situations?
With the interview and Seth Rogen and whatever, you know, months and months before that attack in November of 2014, North Korea stated that releasing a movie about the assassination of their leader would be considered an act of war. So I think, you know, in retrospect, of course, now you're like, oh, okay, they meant that, right? They meant business. I think at the time everybody was like, okay, yeah, sure, it's an act of war, but it's a Seth Rogen movie. You know, I think now in terms of do we have a handle on what they're capable of, you know, I think that they continue to surprise us. They do things that are, you know, not consistent with what we would have expected a targeted intrusion actor to do. But I think across the whole space, we're seeing cyber, you know, escalations in cyberspace that we hadn't really seen for the years before, where it was kind of quiet espionage. Now we're seeing destructive attacks. We're seeing things like NotPetya. And, you know, I think it's not just North Korea. I think we're seeing an escalation in what various actors are doing in the digital realm.
Adam Meyer of the firm CrowdStrike, thank you so much for coming on board the Security Ledger.
Sure thing.
The actions of Russian hackers have been a topic of intense interest in 2017, as details have emerged about the influence campaign that is believed to have been carried out by the government of Russian President Vladimir Putin against the campaign of Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton and other Democratic candidates in 2016. The Russian campaign is generally regarded as one of the most effective in the long history of spycraft between the governments of Russia and the U.S., and that's saying something. But it hasn't come without cost to Russia and its interests. Kaspersky Lab, a Moscow-based antivirus software maker and Russia's most prominent technology firm, has been the subject of intense scrutiny in 2017. Its software has been linked to the theft of classified cyber offensive weapons. That story and others landed Kaspersky on a Department of Homeland Security blacklist. In our next segment from episode number 66, which aired in October, we speak with Dave Itell of the firm Immunity Inc. about the charges leveled against Kaspersky Lab and whether they're just sour grapes by the U.S. government or, as Itell believes, a legitimate and serious warning about the potential for Kaspersky's software and other software like it to be used for spying. Joining us now in the Security Ledger podcast, we have Dave Itell, who is the CEO of Immunity Inc. Dave, welcome to Security Ledger podcast.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's great to have you. There's been so much going on with regard to Kaspersky Lab. A lot of questions that were floating in the air for many years are suddenly being asked out loud. And the thing that really has moved the story forward is this story that came out in a Wall Street Journal that seemed to connect the dots between Kaspersky and Russian intelligence, saying that their software may have played a role in the theft of some offensive cyber tools from an NSA contractor. What are your thoughts on that report, and what might we be talking about? How might this have gone down?
I mean, my thoughts, like any of these things, what you see the community reacting to is this desire to believe Kaspersky is innocent. And, you know, we have a genuine and I think very healthy suspicion of anything coming from the government, especially anything that has been marked anonymous sources and is getting fed out through a friendly newspaper. But it's a probable reality that Kaspersky is dirty. And that may not mean Eugene himself is dirty. It may just mean that his organization's been penetrated by the Russians to a point where they use his product as a signals intelligence engine. And it looks like that's what they got caught doing. And I think it's, you know, there's a lot of noise from Eugene over Twitter where he's saying, hey, if we've been penetrated, let us know. We're happy to help look into it. And I just don't think that matters from a national security perspective and even from a commercial perspective. I think anyone smart and, you know, Immunity's clients are all big financials. So they're ripping out not just Kaspersky, but anything that looks like Kaspersky for you know, what they would essentially consider a capital crime in the market. So, I mean, the claim, which is a little vague, as all you know, top secret leaks are, is that a NSA employee took data home. That data was discovered by Kaspersky's agent and then pulled onto Kaspersky's cloud, and then it got to the Russian government. And I think the question Eugene refuses to answer on Twitter is, even if everything, every other part of that was normal, the part where it goes to the Russian government is not normal. That is not a thing that would normally happen. And, you know, Eugene's trying to say that it's, you know, it was probably just Trojans and whatnot that he already had signatures for. I think that's very unlikely as an explanation. You know, when we talk about documents being taken, very rarely did documents trigger any kind of real signatures. What probably happened was they knew that he was in Colombia because they know what the ISP was. And the Russians specifically targeted people in Colombia who they possibly knew worked for the NSA and had their product on their laptops. And they got a directory listing, and then they looked through the directory listing and they picked up the files they thought were interesting. And then when those files were interesting, they picked up the rest of them. So I think they're dirty. I don't think it's that complex, but, you know, we want to believe. I get it. We're all Mulder, and we want to, you know, he says he's innocent, you know, like, that's cool.
Wow. You really dated yourself with that X-Files reference.
X-Files is back. What are you talking about? It's new. They've got a new one.
Oh yeah. I forgot about that. This gets at the crux of the Kaspersky lab, and for you know, purposes of disclosure, obviously, I was an employee at Kaspersky Lab's Threat Post for 2 years, from 2010 to 2012. So,
well, let's talk about Threat Post, and let's talk about SAS, because if they're dirty, the most dangerous thing you can do is browse Threat Post and go to SAS, and we just don't want to believe that, but it could very well be true. It's what I would build if I was the Russians.
Right. So SAS is the Security Analyst Summit. It was a it is a very well attended, high profile security summit that happens at various nice resorts around the world.
You're telling me that doesn't come with an FSB technical team? Really? Like, it's impossible. We're that gullible.
Yeah.
But yet, I see it on the, well, wow, yeah. FS, sound, let's go to Cancun. All expenses paid. Yay. All right. Anyway.
Yeah, that is how it worked, which is Kaspersky generally would pay for folks to travel there, not only employees, but the speakers and many of the guests.
Many of the guests. Name another conference that pays for guests. Look, these people are dirty.
Yeah.
It's so obvious.
Well, I never saw an FSB technical team there, Dave.
Yeah, I'm sure you didn't.
And I went into many different rooms. But the crux of the argument from Kaspersky is that, you know, we are happy to submit our antivirus engine source code for analysis. We're happy to have anybody look at it. But what you're saying is there doesn't need to be anything in the end product, the product that gets installed, for, as you say, for the company to have been compromised or to be, as you say, dirty.
I think we all know that. I think we know there's nothing you can show technically that would clear their name. And that's an unfortunate reality of their business and all businesses. I mean, the same thing's true of every business in America. And I, you know, as much as I think they're probably on the wrong end of this argument, you have to point out the U.S. government has not said, look, we would never ask a U.S. company to do something similar,
right?
Like, and that's, it's not, and the funny thing is we all want to talk about vulnerability equities, but this is the real equity. This is the business killing equity, is right, whether or not you're going to ask a company to help you drive your signals intelligence, and in some cases your human intelligence.
Right.
And it's either on the table or not. And what we're saying now is that if you get caught, we're going to ban you. But is it an assumption of capability that we want everyone to have? Like, are we driving toward balkanization, as I think you've mentioned in the past on your podcast, or do we not want that? And we never made a top level decision. So we're sort of just floating out there without a rudder, which is fine. But I mean, we're not saying that they are evil. We're saying you've gotten caught.
Right. And to play devil's advocate, I mean, that is the question, which is, do Symantec and McAfee do this on behalf of the U.S. government? Does Trend Micro do it on behalf of the Japanese government? There are Chinese-based antivirus companies. So is this just the state of play in, you know, you've got companies that are in essence selling, you know, kernel mode rootkits called antivirus engines. Are all of them compromised in this way?
Even if the company's American, people who work there aren't all Americans, right? Like, that's not how this industry works. There's no such thing as an American antivirus. I mean, there's top Chinese people who used to work for their signals intelligence arm working at some of the antivirus companies I know.
Sure.
And we're okay with it, right? Like, okay, let's install McAfee and Symantec.
Yeah.
So at what point are they so important to your national security that you have to vet their employees, right? Like, or is the rule, if we catch you using our human and signals intelligence, then we ban you. And like, if you knowingly did something bad, you get banned. And I just think we could use some clarity. I mean, every one of the policy arguments always calling for clarity, and there's never any clarity. But these are tough questions.
And we're seeing this with not only the, you know, we're seeing this and the willingness to use software as a attack vector, obviously with the CCleaner attacks and the NotPetya attacks using the MeDocs. Is this just, are those just, you know, the sort of tip of the iceberg of a much bigger question around software supply chain and the integrity of all of the, you know, third-party applications you might be using within your organization?
Yeah, and I think, I mean, it's just the beginning of where we think government should go. I mean, you know, all these questions we don't have answers to. I feel like this was where the Obama administration had a window and they dropped the ball. And to its credit, the Trump administration is much, much better at cyber policy than the Obama administration. But they haven't been around for too long. And this the window might have closed. And that's kind of a sad fact.
So where does this go now? You know, obviously you've got Best Buy and Office Depot pulling Kaspersky off their shelves in the U.S. Office Depot, as I reported yesterday, actually offering to remove Kaspersky's product for free and install McAfee in its place. You know, this cannot be good for the top or bottom line at Kaspersky Lab. Where does this all lead? Are we going to look back on the sort of last 10 or 15 years as a sort of halcyon time where there was this idea of, well, we're all just, you know, consumers in a big global marketplace for technology and talent, the walls are going to go up. And, you know, if you're an American, you work for American companies. If you're Russian, you work for Russian companies serving Russian customers.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, that's always existed to some extent. And, you know, I think a big question is, I'm carefully keeping an eye on what the Brits do. Because the Brits have always been halfway, in a sense, right? Like, even with Huawei, they're like, yeah, we're going to ban them here, but we'll allow Huawei to build parts of our internet. I mean, the Australians did the same thing. I think the Huawei built the Australian giant cable modem network or whatever it is. So it's, I mean, there are some tells, I would like to say, some international tells to see what other organizations who've probably been read in on the actual intelligence, I want to see what they do. And I don't know how much of that's a matter of their national policy, how much of it's just random chance that someone doesn't trust someone else, and how much of that is the intelligence itself being damning. So, you know, I mean, the Germans are another. I asked the Germans the other day, I'm like, hey, are you guys pulling this out? And they're like, no, not really. But, I mean, you know, the Germans are very suspicious of American intelligence, and maybe they don't believe that American intelligence has caught Kaspersky doing something dirty. And they're also quite close to the Russians. I think people are a little bit not aware of how close the German economy is to the Russian economy and the rest of the situation there. But I mean, if you see the German retailers pull Kaspersky, then you know that they've been read in and someone's talked to someone and that company is dead. And then we're in your world, your little dystopian world.
You advise companies on their security. This type of stuff must be terrifying to you if you work at a, you know, sophisticated organization with valuable intellectual property, because antivirus obviously is one of the pillars of any corporation's, you know, IT security program. What would your advice be? I mean, what can you really do about this type of a threat?
I have to be honest, this is one of the reasons we do almost all of our business in the big financials and the people who supply the big financials. I mean, they have a healthy paranoia that they back up with money. So, you know, I mean, I don't think this is something that's an extreme for them in terms of their threat model. I mean, to be fair, when I go into a lot of the big financials, they view every government, our own included, as first-rate threats, and they have been designing and building systems to counteract that. The PRISM report that came out a while back was very heavily in their thing. You know, governments do a lot of work surveilling big financials, and they've all started realizing that even internally, they need a security program that can take on that kind of threat. And some of them have the budget to do it, and some of them don't, but they still try, which is fine. They have so many problems in security that very little of their CISOs are getting sleep at night, which is why I'm not a CISO for a giant financial. But for other organizations, you know, some of them are so far behind the eight ball that this isn't going to ring their bell. You know what I mean? Like, this may not rise to their level of urgency. It may just be an interesting, you know, report that they read about that they can't quite handle yet.
So you're going to be going to the Security Analyst Summit this year?
I've never been. And I have a feeling after this podcast, my invitation will be revoked. Look, and I actually feel really bad for all of the Kaspersky engineers and, you know, even for Eugene himself, if this turns out to be something that's been a little bit overblown, which I don't believe it is. But, you know, 99.99% of the Kaspersky employees probably knew nothing about this and are as white hat gets. It's, you know, and it's a sad fact of life that any organization can be destroyed by a strategic mistake that puts you in bed with one or another government. And that's just something I think every company has learned, and it's very hard to clear your name.
Yeah.
I think it's a spectrum. I would hardly like to say the United States is, you know, a bastion of perfect, you know, governance, but certainly we at some times are confused about our own rules, even though we do follow them, but we do make an attempt to follow rules, which I think does set us apart a little bit. You know, Kaspersky will claim that they're headquartered in the UK, at least corporately. I don't know what the adverb for that is or whatever it is. They would claim that they have resisted such pressures if there were any, and that, you know, obviously the Russian government would not do this to their shining star. And, you know, that's their argument. I just don't know if it holds any water, like you say. Any of these issues where we say this is against the norms of behavior, therefore you're getting either sanctioned or we're going to, you know, publicly advise no one uses your stuff. I think we need to make sure that we're taking a step back and saying, what is it we do we should be restricting? Mm-hmm. Are there barriers? Like, should we say, look, we do this too, but only to two people a year and only in the cases of nuclear, biological, or chemical weaponry or something? Mm-hmm. I don't know what the rules of the road are, or should we just simply say we do have rules for how we do this and we do follow them? You know, I don't mean to demonize what Kaspersky did, but I don't think we should be in the dark about messages that are being sent. And I feel like a lot of people are definitely, you know, trying to put their head in the sand on what these articles mean.
Yeah,
and it's just not confusing what the government's accusing Kaspersky of, unless you're reading his Twitter,
right?
Like, it seems pretty clear to me. They're saying, you're a signals intelligence organization, and we don't like that. Right? Like, it's not that complex. It's not, we don't think someone exploited your product. No, we think they used your product as it was intended.
Yeah, this is not new. These warnings or rumblings have certainly been going on for many years.
And you don't get proof in this world. You're supposed to have trust, and we apparently don't have that either.
Yes.
So that's why it feels so bad. Is, I guess, where I come from.
Yeah. Dave Itell, CEO of Immunity, Inc., thank you so much for coming on the Security Ledger podcast.
Thank you so much.
Depictions of hacking and hackers on television and in the movies are generally forgettable. But as the figure of the hacker has moved closer to the center of our culture, Hollywood has gotten smarter. Witness the USA Network's Mr. Robot, a serial thriller centered on the activities of a gifted young hacker who belongs to an anarchist hacktivist collective bent on social transformation. The show's been a hit not just with the public, but also with cybersecurity professionals who marvel at its accurate depictions of breaking into sensitive systems, right down to the software packages used, the commands typed on screen, and the myriad soft skills hackers must draw on to work their way onto sensitive networks. How does Mr. Robot get it so right? Simple. They hire real hackers like our next guest, Ryan Kazantchian, the chief security architect at the firm Tanium, to advise them. Kazantchian has served as a consultant to the show's writers for the past two seasons. In our next segment, from episode 68, which aired in October, he talked to us about how he came to be a consultant on the show and the challenge of making hacking look real on the small screen. On the line now with us is Ryan Kazantchian, who is the chief security architect at the firm Tanium. Ryan, welcome to Security Ledger Podcast.
Hi, Paul. Thank you so much for having me. I was originally connected to the show through a colleague and friend, Dave D'Amato, who's actually Tanium's chief security officer. And he had been at an event a couple of years ago, right after season one had completed, with Corradana, who's one of the writers and producers on the show, who really focuses on making it accurate. And through Dave, he introduced Core to Andre McGregor, who is a director of internal security here and a former FBI Cyber Squad agent. And so Andre consulted the show on a lot of the FBI-related aspects. And then I was brought in to help midway through season two on some of the technology and hacks shown in the show. And so I did a couple of scenes where, you know, the outline had already been crafted, and I basically build out the technology and the screens and the workflow of hacks shown in the tail end of season two. And then I worked with the writers from the very start of season three, collaborating with Core and team to basically create some of the arcs of how technology and hacks would be woven into the season. And then all the way through to actually doing the production work on dozens upon dozens of scenes that feature security tools, hacking, and other uses of technology. And so that's been my night job since last year, October, I think. So practically a year of work. And so it's been really excited to see that all come to fruition with season three airing. And it premiered last week. We just had episode two on last night on Wednesday. Among the many tools that we wove into the show, I managed to get a quick glimpse of Tanium deploying a package to install a patch. So you briefly see that on screen and the first minutes in episode two of season three. The show obviously addresses a really broad audience, right?
Yes.
Like you've got security, the security crowd who like literally pauses every single screen and scrutinizes it, which is super fun. Like that's, you know, why we try to make it so accurate, because they care and we love making it real. I also had a shot with IDA Pro in last night's episode. I always had wanted to get IDA into a scene and, you know, weave in some bits around binary analysis and reverse engineering. And right after the show aired, someone on Twitter who's a security team for Google tweeted something to the effect of, I never thought 2017 would be the year of IDA Pro on primetime television. So it's really fun to like take some of the tools and techniques that people in the security community work up with every day and like bring it to the masses and, you know, give them little Easter eggs and eye candy on the technology side, but also try to make it accessible for a general audience and introduce them to some of those concepts.
It's interesting because obviously the film industry has a very fraught history with the information security community, you know, that hacks were always depicted as just somebody kind of pounding away at a keyboard and just magically guessing the password, you know, I'm in, you know, that type of thing. What are the and obviously that comes from the writers, but so what, like when you get outlines of scenarios from these writers, you know, what are they like? How fleshed out are they?
You know, everything starts out as kind of a primordial ooze of ideas that get pitched back and forth in the writer's room in the early days. And I remotely dialed in and worked with Core quite a bit during those sessions to pitch ideas, especially the ones involved with hacks. And a lot of ideas ended up on the cutting room floor. A lot changed drastically from how they first started. The fun thing about that process is, you know, you have people with all different backgrounds and experiences. And so you get a lot of ideas that are, you know, at first blush, maybe not possible technically or a little too out there. And it's kind of fun to rein those in and think about, okay, well, you know, how can we make this realistic and still entertaining? And that's kind of a evolution and a bit of compromise. For me, one of the cool things about it is, you know, I've learned to you know, try to think like an attacker, which is something that I try to do in my day job and as long as I've been in InfoSec. And sometimes you get an idea or a challenge that sounds crazy, and then you really start thinking it through and realize it can be done. And if you read the headlines for some of the more elaborate hacks that we've seen in the past years, the same is true of those. I remember reading one about a particularly elaborate banking heist that involved well-coordinated ATM withdrawals and internal hacks that just made the news a few weeks ago. And it's the same sort of thing. If you just describe that, it sounds so crazy that it could actually happen, but it does. People plan and execute. So in many ways, the show is kind of like that. You get the ideas, you figure out how to make it work and to make it real.
You know, the relationship between movies and the public's understanding of hacking is a pretty important one. I mean, arguably the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act was a response to the movie War Games and some of its depictions of computer intrusions. And I think more recently, you know, the pacemaker hack that I think was in, what was that, Homeland or I can't remember what show, got a lot of attention to embedded device security. So do you ever think about sort of the power that's in your hands as you design these attacks that there could be some public response to that?
So, I mean, we're undoubtedly influenced by, you know, the backdrop of breaches and hacks and vulnerabilities that, you know, we read about every day. One of the interesting things is that, you know, the show is still set in the 2015 timeframe. Mm-hmm. And so we incorporate hacks and technology, we have to stay accurate to that. And so for the most part, you know, whenever you see anything, it has to be, you know, true to the time. We sometimes will extend that a little bit. But yes, undoubtedly, like, you know, reality ends up influencing fiction. And I'm, you know, I would say vice versa, that yep. The thing is, if you look at the types of hacks that we see in the real world today, it's hard to get to imagine that a fiction could be crazier than that, right? Like from the DNC hacks to the major financial hacks to use of destructive malware to, you know, cause hundreds of millions of dollars in businesses, like to businesses like NotPetya did. Reality is crazy, and it sometimes feels like everything is on fire. It's hard, you know. It's sometimes interesting to see when we'll write something into the show and then see a very similar hack play out in real life. And there's also certainly cases where real world stuff has influenced what we create. The two seem inexorably linked.
Ryan Kazantzian, thank you so much for coming in and talking to the Security Ledger podcast. It was great having you.
Thanks so much for having me. Great to talk to you, Paul.
And finally, what makes a good chief security officer? That was a question we found ourselves asking in the wake of the Equifax hack. That company's CSO, Susan Malden, was forced to retire from Equifax shortly after news of the breach broke, and her undergraduate music major became proof for some that Equifax wasn't serious about security. In our final segment from episode number 63, which aired in September, we invited two experts in to debate the fraught issue of qualifications in the information security field. Noted hacker Chris Roberts of the firm Acalvio and Deidre Diamond of CyberSN, an information security staffing firm. I started out by asking Roberts and Diamond about the criticism of Malden and whether they thought it was fair to attack her choice of undergraduate major as a reflection of her security expertise or lack thereof. With us in the studio, we have Chris Roberts, who is the chief security architect at the firm Acalvio, and Deidre Diamond, the founder and CEO of CyberSN.
Yeah, thanks for having us again, sir.
Oh, it's great to have you. So we're talking today about the kind of reaction. There have been so many reactions to this Equifax. One kind of subtext that came out was around their chief information security officer, who is a woman and also, as it turns out, has a background in music, not computer science or engineering. And there was, from some corners of the internet, a reaction to that, a pretty negative one. Of course they got breached. And I'd start with you, Chris. You had a pretty strong reaction to it, and maybe just kind of reprise that for us using as family-friendly language as you can.
Yeah, I think my reaction online, even on LinkedIn, which I consider to be my civilized reaction, was pretty blunt. I was, to your point, you know, somebody had taken a snippet of that particular lady's LinkedIn profile, put it up there, and it basically expanded the fact that they did not think that somebody with a music major should be in charge of security and should have anything to do with security, and not surprised that they got breached and a whole bunch of other things. To which point, I think I explained exactly which orifice they could put their head in that their elitist view was absolutely incorrect, and how dare they, given the fact that so many of us in security have kind of worked our way in, clawed our way up, and, you know, we stand on the experience that we have, and we build on the experience of others, as opposed to, you know, racking up 7 years worth of debt in a college environment. And it's not to say the college is bad, it's just this realm that we have created over the last 20 plus years has only recently lent itself to certification, and most of us have got, you know, the scars and bruises from so many years of experience, which arguably count for as much, if not more, in some cases.
The information security space has a reputation as a place for, as I like to say, sort of misfits and dreamers, people who come from all different types of background. Deidre, you run a placement firm that finds jobs for these people. Is that still the case? Is that true?
It's true in that those people exist. It's not true in that there aren't others. So there are 35 different jobs within cyber that we have categorized. And of the extreme technical roles, you know, there's a lot to say about those folks, you know, falling under that stereotype. And they're sort of the backbone of the cyberspace and the beginners and the folks that, you know, sort of began. However, there's also all kinds of different personas. It's not one. That's the one that media focuses on. That's the one that we stereotype. It is not all that exists by any means.
What did you make of the debate? I mean, I know you read some of it online about this woman, Susan Malden, who is a chief security officer at Equifax and has a bachelor's and master's of fine arts in music composition from University of Georgia. What did you make of that debate? Is that, in your mind, a fair game or a little bit misplaced and misinformed?
Oh, absolutely misplaced, misinformed. It's fascinating to me that anybody that understands this industry, who is in this industry, thinks that an executive is degree in terms of in cyber is what they rely on every day. It's experience. And so it's absolutely ridiculous. What really interested me the most from this was that, you know, this was a top 10 vulnerability, so we think, or what we've heard so far. And in our, you know, circle, that is sort of what gets done on a daily basis. Your top patches, it sort of never gets overlooked. It's what you do when you come in if it's a top 10, right? And you're talking 2 months of that being open. The first thing I thought of is what I see every day in the workplace, which is understaffed and under budgeted in security. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't take away that she's negligent, that the leadership in that company is negligent. I mean, to miss a top 10 vulnerability is negligence, for sure. If that's what happened, that's a problem. It's not because of her degree, and it's not to take away that she is responsible. When I went online to see how many jobs are open in cyber at Equifax now, there's 17. 17.
Yeah.
That's the problem. And when you think about our retention stats of 12 to 18 months, when you look at an organization like this and you see 17 roles on their website today, I think to myself, they are completely understaffed. And that's why a top 10 vulnerability gets missed, not a degree.
Chris, I was going to ask you, how fair is it to blame the CISO or the CSO for, you know, missing a struts patch, a 10 criticality struts patch? Is that...
You know, it's tough because you've got two attitudes. You've got the captains who go down with the ship. They are ultimately responsible. You know, at the end of the day, it's their team that should be doing the work, doing everything else. But one of the arguments a very positive argument we had online was, honestly, on a day-to-day activity, how much is that CISO going to actually rely upon the management and the staff and the directors to tell them, hey, all is good? I mean, how many of us have put, you know, our version of the TPS report together to send up to leadership to say all's good? So the failure is potentially at, you know, whoever's watching the borders, whoever's looking at the external interfaces, or potentially the vendor or the supplier that's doing the work for them. You know, a lot of companies are now, obviously, you know, the MSSP model comes into play, and somebody else is looking at your perimeter to allow you to focus more on the business. Therefore, you get a nice TPS report from them going, hey, we're all clear. And as a CISO, you have to put the trust in those people that they're doing their job properly. So is it the fact they didn't have the right people? There's obviously a dearth of people around, so they didn't have enough staff. And at which point in time, it's like, okay, did somebody just not do their job? At which point should the CISO take the fall, or should the CISO not take the fall? Because again, you know, maybe the CISO has been banging on the CFO's table or the CEO's table going, hey, I need those resources. We're not protected. I don't have enough protection to, I don't know, get rid of an admin ID and password in South America, let alone all the other vulnerabilities that have cropped up over the last couple of years. So they might have been doing the best job they possibly can, and they're losing the argument for whatever business, financial, economic reason. So that's my thoughts on it.
Chris, did that TPS report have a cover page on it or not?
Oh, beautiful.
You got the memo, right? You got the memo about that?
Oh, my God, yeah. But that's what it falls down to when you think about it. I mean, that really is what it comes down to.
Chris, you had a typically atypical path into the security world. Maybe talk a little bit about that. And if people don't know you, you're the guy with kind of the multicolored beard at the Security Con, one of the most respected security researchers out there. But you didn't go right down the middle of the road. So talk a little bit about how you made your way to the industry.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I started messing with computers when I was 9, 10 years old. I spent a year at boarding school messing with a ZX80 and a ZX81 that another kid had brought with him. So we were building device drivers and various other things for it. At 14 or 15, I think it was, I hacked into a bank in the UK, and I had my, you know, Commodore 64 and Atari confiscated because, you know, we'd done the things that we probably shouldn't have done back then. And this was, you know, late 70s, well, early 80s at that point. So it went from there. I left school when I was 15. You know, I came out with a bunch of O-levels and a bunch of OA-levels. I left school at 15. I went into the workforce for a variety of home family reasons, then did military time, and then kind of went back into the IT infrastructure. I kind of went back in as a screwdriver-wielding techie, floppy disk in one hand, screwdriver in the other hand. First line, then did obviously network stuff, worked up from there. I was very fortunate that a couple of companies I worked for put me through, you know, the Microsoft certified stuff back in the late 90s, my CIFFP and the MCT and some of the other CCIE stuff. But I worked my ass off. It was one of those where this is an interesting environment. I spent a year-ish back at Oxford messing around with stuff on the crypto side and mathematics side, but I don't have a degree. I don't have an undergrad. The only thing I had to my name was, you know, a bunch of certificates which have expired over the years, but I kind of took the life version and kind of went that direction, to be honest.
And as you look around you at your peers, is that an unusual story, or are there other stories like that or similar to that? And I'll note, you know, one of the most well-respected hackers in North America, Peter Zadko, or Mudge. Berklee School of Music, right? Berklee School of Music.
Mudge is exactly the same, yeah. And you've got other guys. It's actually been interesting because I actually copied the rant from LinkedIn and dropped it out onto Twitter as well. And I've had some ridiculously good conversations. And there's a lot of people out there who clawed their way up, worked their way up. It's the mindset, you know. It's all about the human, to Deirdre's point. You know, the certificate is good, but the human behind it is what counts. And if that human's got a thirst for knowledge, that means more to me than any certificate. It's how we used to recruit. When I had a former company of mine, we did our recruitment based on who the human was. I can teach you all the tech in the world, but if you're not the person who's inquisitive or who likes to find 10 different ways into something, this isn't the career for you as far as we were concerned for what we were looking for.
Deirdre, you're the recruiter in the room. How do companies who are looking for talent balance a unconventional resume, let's say, with the need?
Well, it's every company's different. There's no, you know, universal process that organizations have been able to get behind and utilize such that you could say there's you know, one or two or three even models. And so it really depends. I can tell you that a degree in cyber, if you're going into the financial world or the healthcare world and you want to get into leadership, it matters. Still today, doors can be shut without it at the executive level. In the software business world, the innovation of building products, it's you know, nobody even looks at it. In fact, in a lot of environments, degrees and certifications, particularly if you're talking about folks like Chris, people see it as, why'd you put the, you know, you shouldn't even put your certs on your resume if you have them. Like, it's all right, Chris? It's almost like,
yep.
What's wrong with you? You can't possibly be one of the best if you're putting certs and degrees on your resume. And so it's a fascinating, thing to run a staffing agency that only works within cyber. And that's why I really created this 35 jobs matrix, because there, what everybody needs to understand is there's lots of different roles and there's different requirements for those roles.
Let me ask you this, because I look at Susan Malden's LinkedIn profile, or what there is of it in some of these posts, because I think she made it private after this stuff started circulating, which I think in some ways is a mistake, because it seems like she's not standing by her credentials. But, you know, you look at her previous employment, First Data Corporation, SunTrust Bank, Hewlett Packard. I mean, you know, clearly this is somebody who has worked at, you know, very reputable organizations, and I'm guessing built up her resume and her expertise around information security. You know, reading some of the comments, I wonder, is this about Susan being a music major, or frankly, is this about Susan being a woman? And I ask you honestly, I wonder if we would be having this conversation if she were the CISO with the exact same resume, but a man.
Yeah. Well, you saw my email to you. It said, oh, please tell me it's not a woman.
I didn't respond to that. Yeah. Because it's like,
I know you didn't. I found it myself.
I'd lay money we wouldn't be having the conversation, which is
right.
Another thing that annoys the hell out of me.
I do wonder how much of a part of this debate is really the other debate, which is about women in the workplace or women in roles that have traditionally been done by men, and women being held to a higher standard than men are doing the same job.
Yeah, well, if we want to use math as the law, right, we've got 1% of women that exist, like, in her role. There's 1% of her, 1% of me in cyber. And then there's 10% overall, and that includes any position. So, you know, the math says this is an overarching problem, right, Chris? I mean, women are...
I didn't realize yeah. It was that low. That's yes. Freaking ridiculous.
Yes, and the statistics that came out from ISC Squared, they're leaving. They're leaving faster than
that.
You know, like, they're leaving because of how they're treated.
Just to clarify the statistics error, that was 1% women in CXO positions, and then 10% of women overall in information security.
It's 1% of women in technical executive roles, and cyber is it's 1 to 4%. Cyber is 1%. In all of tech, it goes to 4%.
I mean, it doesn't surprise me, because, I mean, you think of where this industry came from and you think of where it's going, and, you know, on one minute we think we're making progress, on the next minute we're bashing our heads against the facts that some flipping Neanderthal makes a comment somewhere and you're like, what the hell are you playing at? So it's frustrating, because it's frustrating. I was at a conference, oh gosh, several months ago now, and there was some other conference going on, like in one of the other halls, and there were a number of us who sat there, put our feet up, and just watched the diverse, I guess, people that were coming in and out of this other conference. And most of us were sitting there going, I wish we had such a diverse audience.
Yeah.
Because we didn't. I mean, it's a mostly male, white male-centric kind of an audience, and it's like, good God, what the hell could we be if we had a more diverse, you know, culture inside that? And we're getting better at it. Don't get me wrong. I'm not bashing it, but we got to recognize that we're our own worst enemies to some degree.
We're getting better at having the conversation, for sure. We're getting better at pointing to the problem and saying this is a problem. I'm not sure, to Deidre's point, that we're getting better in terms of actually getting and keeping more people in the field. But I agree with you, Chris. We're definitely getting better talking about it.
Keeping them in the field. I mean, that's, and then the question is, as you start taking a look back at, so where do we have to look at this? I can't remember. Somebody showed me some statistics not too long ago about the number, you know, my daughters, I got a 17 and a 13 year old. My 13 year old's looking at me going, I don't want to go into your field. And I'm like, no, I can't say I blame you in some ways, but yeah, I'm going to help you as best as I can, because there's not as much encouragement at the school level and the college level and the high school level. So it's like, we almost have to go back to that area and go, hey, what do we need to do better to help the professors and the students actually come into this field more effectively.
Yeah.
And I have to speak up here. We just, the BrainBabe platform, Paul, which you know of, I can't remember if you've heard of it, Chris, but it's brainbabe.org. It's a not-for-profit where we're working on these statistics that we're talking about. And we launched STEAMCon Connection. And that is, we're connecting STEAM students to conference jobs. So no more booth babes. So nobody has an excuse anymore. They can call me and I will make sure that who's working those booths are interested, students in all fields or all degrees of going to school, or anybody, quite frankly. I'm not going to tell somebody they can't, apply, but these jobs that we're giving to modeling agencies at our event, first of all, waste of a job when they're not interested. And number two, it adds to the problem of discrimination and sexual harassment, right? Because we've got all this sexualization going on. So ISC Squared Congress was our first event that we're staffing, Hacker Halted.
And let's just flip this on its head. I mean, Deidre, is it a possibility that having a background, or Chris, I think you're probably qualified to answer this as well, having a background in music or composition might actually really contribute to your job as a chief information security officer or chief security officer? Obviously, it's not in and of itself enough to qualify you, but that type of background and schooling, can it be an asset to you in your career?
Yeah. So for me, it's an absolute yes. In that, if you're at an executive level in cyber, your job is managing people, culture, mindsets, and yes, of course, policies and procedures. It's the number one area we all or humans struggle in is the relationship. We see it in our retention stats that I mentioned earlier. And that is the hardest piece of the job. And so having an arts background, having a background or a degree that's more around communication is a benefit. It helps. It doesn't mean that not having it is a problem or having it is a problem. It's just another angle of a part of the job that's difficult.
I'll take the brainiac side of the concept on this one, which is, I come from the math background, so problem solving. You think, what is music? Music is nothing more than basically problem solving at near real time. So the whole concept of being able to apply notes, apply yourself, and being able to do problem solving on a variety of different instruments. I mean, so many people I know can play 4, 5, 6 different instruments. It's crazy. So what that does for the brain and how it opens the brain up is huge for our industry. And then to Deirdre's point, the ability for that person to actually be in a college-level situation where they have to obviously be articulate, they have to have eloquence, they have to have a level of understanding and communication, it's huge. I don't care whether you come from that background or whatever, just the simple fact that you have that part of the brain that's getting exercised, that's perfect for me.
So where do we go from here? I guess it's a perception problem that, again, security industry people eat their own. How do we change that and make it more welcoming, not just to women and, arts or humanities folks, but also just to everybody, bring more people in by maybe putting the knives away?
So there's, for me, a couple of things. I think you hit it earlier on, the lady from Equifax, the fact she's taken her profile offline, I think I would really encourage you to put it back online and put something out there and say, hey, this is who I am. If you have a problem with me, love to have a conversation with you over a cup of tea, cup of coffee, or a drink of bloody scotch, number one. Number two, I'd love for her to put a flipping blog post out and actually really go through the what's, the why's, the how's. Not necessarily to defend herself, but go, hey, this is who I am. Now you understand. That would be huge for me. And quite honestly, as much as I want to taser people, Kathy Allman up in Buffalo won't let me do that, so I'm not allowed to taser the Neanderthals.
Put the taser away.
I think it's going to take more of us doing this kind of thing, being more positive, getting out there, doing the outreach stuff. I mean, getting into the universities, getting into the schools, and saying, hey, this is who we are. Come and join us. We're not the Neanderthals. We're not the idiots. We actually know what the hell we're doing, and we'd love to have you come join us. And by the way, if an idiot does decide to troll you or become a Neanderthal, let us know, because we'll have a nice discussion about re-education.
I think that we need to invest in recognizing that cyber divisions of our organizations are like no other division that we've ever seen or had before, and stop lumping them into a department like everybody else. They're not. They're an emergency center. They operate under high stress. They are understaffed. They don't have the tools they need. I think this breach is a prime example of what it means to be understaffed. I don't say it because I own a staffing agency. I've built two software companies. I've been 13 years running a technical staffing agency that didn't do cyber. And I can tell you this is completely different. And the biggest risk that we have every day beyond understaffing our teams is the culture that we put them in and expect them to be operating like everybody else, you know, work on, things day and night for 3 days and still be at an 8 a.m. meeting. I think we have to look at how we assimilate these folks into our businesses. And I think we must look at soft skills because we are communicating so poorly with each other that we're actually causing these retention rates. 63% of cyber professionals were recently spoken to about why they left their company. They said they would have stayed if there was respect and kindness.
Wow.
No joke.
Wow.
Chris, what are your thoughts on that?
Security is everybody's problem now. It isn't the security guy who's always in the way. It's like, hey, this is all of our problems. This isn't going away with training once a year or any of that. Everybody's got to step up and go, hey, I'm going to own a bit of the security issue and I'm going to help everybody on this one. Therefore, what can we collectively, collaboratively do to make the situation better?
Let me ask you a final question, and it's a tough one, which is Equifax is now in a very difficult position. I mean, clearly in the wake of this incident, you would imagine there are going to be changes at the very top ranks of that company, just given how badly this all went for them. On the other hand, if the CIS or the chief security officer is let go, some may see it as a response to these criticisms about her qualifications and, her background rather than for what happened. So if you're Equifax, I guess, how do you handle this? How do you handle Susan Malden?
I think I would look at Susan and go, who, especially if I'm on the board, and go, who did you work with? Why did this happen? Did it happen because the CFO didn't provide mm-hmm. you with the resources? Did it happen because you were not eloquent enough to describe the situation? Did it happen because the board failed and put profit ahead of security? The blame shouldn't necessarily fall to her if the CEO, CIO, CFO, or whoever else has failed to adequately understand the problem. Now, if she has failed to adequately communicate the problem, then yes, she should be held responsible. But yeah, a head should roll. But if the finance guy is not handing it over because they value profit over security, somebody needs to take the finance guy out and tar and feather him, as far as I'm concerned.
Deidre?
Yeah, I'd agree. I mean, I'd agree. Look, does she have the tools to know whether these things were patched? And does she have the talent to use the tools so that she knows if things are patched? Is this a negligence of her paying attention, or is this a negligence of her not having the staff? And if it's a negligence of her not paying attention, that's a clear, makes sense to me. If this is a negligence of talent and budget, well, I hope, and I hope she's strong enough, and we need to see CISOs doing this. We need to see them come out saying, for X amount of time, I've been asking for X, and I've submitted how many times, we must come forth as leaders and share, because I can tell you how many times I hear from these executives on security, and they say, well, I brought up the risk so many times that I was finally told, if you bring it up again, there's a problem. And at that moment, what does one do? One chooses to stay, then bring forth the information, stand your ground or leave if that happens.
Yeah.
I mean, this is what's happening out there. And so we need leaders like her and others to really talk about what's going on, because I would imagine that that's what's happened. I would imagine she's asked for the budget. I would imagine that she's asked to use staffing agencies to fill her jobs and she's been told no. I guarantee it.
Or the NSSP filed, or exactly. I think you're right.
Yes.
And to your point, it's one of those where if you believe the principles of what you're doing, you unfortunately have that option: do you stay and still become mm-hmm. part of the problem, or do you leave
And let's face it, there is a wealth of people that would bring in a good CISO or a good individual or good technical people. There's plenty of companies out there that are crying out for good talent. So it's not exactly as if you're leaving and have nowhere to go, especially if you walk into another organization and say, hey, these are the challenges I came up with last time. This is what was addressed and this is what was not addressed. How are you any different? I mean, those as interview questions to a prospective employer are going to be huge. They will give you an indication as to what's going to go on.
Deidre Diamond, founder and CEO of CyberSN, and Chris Roberts, my brother from another mother, chief security architect at Ocalcio. Thank you both for coming and talking to the Security Ledger.